his neck, the crooks of his elbows. I knew how pleasure looked on him. Our bodies cupped each other like hands. The blankets had twisted around me. He shucked them from us both. The air over my skin was a shock, and I shivered. He was outlined against the painted stars. Polaris sat on his shoulder. His hand slipped over the quickened rise and fall of my belly's breathing. He stroked me gently, as though smoothing finest cloth, and my hips lifted to his touch. I pulled him to me, and trembled, and trembled. He was trembling too. He sounded as though he had been running far and fast. I said his name, I think. It blew through me. I was hollow as a reed hung up for the wind to sound. There was no time that passed but our breaths. I found his hair between my fingers. There was a gathering inside me, a beat of blood against the movement of his hand. His face was pressed against me, but I tried to clutch him closer still. "Do not stop," I said. He did not stop. The feeling gathered and gathered till a hoarse cry leapt from my throat, and the sharp flowering drove me, arching against him. It was not enough. My hand reached, found the place of his pleasure. His eyes closed. There was a rhythm he liked. I could feel it, the catch of his breath, the yearning. My fingers were ceaseless, following each quickening gasp. His eyelids were the color of the dawn sky. He smelled like earth after rain. His mouth opened in an inarticulate cry, and we were pressed so close that I felt the spurt of his warmth against me. He shuddered, and we lay still. Slowly, like dusk fall, I became aware of my sweat, the dampness of the covers and the wetness that slid between our bellies. We separated, peeling away from each other, our faces puffy and half bruised from kisses. The cave smelled hot and sweet, like fruit beneath the sun. Our eyes met, and we did not speak. Fear rose in me, sudden and sharp. This was the moment of truest peril, and I tensed, fearing his regret. He said, "I did not think," and stopped. There was nothing in the world I wanted more than to hear what he had not said. "What?" I asked him. "If it is bad, let it be over quickly." "I did not think that we would ever." He was hesitating over every word, and I could not blame him. "I did not think so either," I said.
"Are you sorry?"
The words were quickly out of him, a single breath. "I am not," I said.
"I am not either."
There was silence then, and I did not care about the damp palate or how sweaty I was. His eyes were unwavering, green flecked with gold. A surety rose in me, lodged in my throat. I will never leave him. It will be this, always, for as long as he will let me. If I had had words to speak such a thing, I would have. But there were none that seemed big enough for it, to hold that swelling truth. As if he had heard me, he reached for my hand. I did not need to look. His fingers were etched into my memory, slender and petal-veined, strong and quick and never wrong.
"Patroclus," he said.
He was always better with words than I. The next morning, I awoke light-headed, my body woozy with warmth and ease. After the tenderness had come more passion. We had been slower then, and lingering, a dreamy night that stretched on and on. Now, watching him stir beside me, his hand resting on my stomach, damp and curled as a flower at dawn, I was nervous again. I remembered in a rush the things I had said and done, the noises I had made. I feared that the spell was broken, that the light that crept through the cave's entrance would turn it all to stone. But then he was awake, his lips forming a half-sleepy greeting, and his hand was already reaching for mine. We lay there, like that, until the cave was bright with morning, and Chiron called. We ate, then ran to the river to wash. I savored the miracle of being able to watch him openly, to enjoy the play of dappled light on his limbs, the curving of his back as he dove beneath the water. Later, we lay on the riverbank, learning the lines of each other's bodies anew. this and this and this. We were like gods at the dawning of the world, and our joy was so bright we could see nothing else but the other. If Chiron noticed change, he did not speak of it, but I could not help worrying. Do you think he will be angry? We were by the olive grove on the north side of the mountain. The breezes were sweetest here, cool and clean as spring water.
I don't think he will.
He reached for my collarbone, the line he liked to draw his finger down. But he might. Surely he must know by now. Should we say something? It was not the first time I had wondered this. We had discussed it often, eager with conspiracy.
If you like.
That is what he had said before. You don't think he will be angry? He paused now, considering. I loved this about him. No matter how many times I had asked, he answered me as if it were the first time. I don't know. His eyes met mine. Does it matter?
I would not stop.
His voice was warm with desire. I felt an answering flush across my skin. But he could tell your father. He might be angry. I said it almost desperately. Soon my skin would grow too warm, and I would no longer be able to think.
So what if he is?
The first time he had said something like this, I had been shocked. That his father might be angry, and Achilles would still do as he wished. It was something I did not understand, could barely imagine. It was like a drug to hear him say it. I never tired of it. What about your mother? This was the trinity of my fears. Chiron, Peleus, and Thetis. He shrugged.
What could she do? Kidnap me?
She could kill me, I thought. But I did not say this. The breeze was too sweet, and the sun too warm for a thought like that to be spoken. He studied me a moment.
Do you care if they are angry?
Yes, I would be horrified to find Chiron upset with me. Disapproval had always burrowed deep in me. I could not shake it off as Achilles did. But I would not let it separate us if it came to that. No, I told him.
Good,
he said. I reached down to stroke the wisps of hair at his temple. He closed his eyes. I watched his face, tipped up to meet the sun. There was a delicacy to his features that sometimes made him look younger than he was. His lips were flushed and full. His eyes opened.
Name one hero who was happy.
I considered. Heracles went mad and killed his family. Theseus lost his bride and father. Jason's children and new wife were murdered by his old. Bellerophon killed the Chimera, but was crippled by the fall from Pegasus's back.
You can't.
He was sitting up now, leaning forward. I can't.
I know. They never let you be famous and happy.
He lifted an eyebrow.
I'll tell you a secret.
Tell me. I loved it when he was like this.
I'm going to be the first.
He took my palm and held it to his.
Swear it.
Why me?
Because you're the reason. Swear it.
I swear it, I said, lost in the high color of his cheeks, the flame in his eyes.
I swear it,
he echoed. We sat like that a moment, hands touching. He grinned.
I feel like I could eat the world raw.
A trumpet blew, somewhere on the slopes beneath us. It was abrupt and ragged, as if sounded in warning. Before I could speak or move, he was on his feet, his dagger out, slapped up from the sheath on his thigh. It was only a hunting knife, but in his hands it would be enough. He stood poised, utterly still, listening with all his half-god senses. I had a knife too. Quietly, I reached for it and stood. He had placed himself between me and the sound. I did not know if I should go to him, stand beside him with my own weapon lifted. In the end, I did not. It had been a soldier's trumpet, and battle, as Chiron had so bluntly said, was his gift, not mine. The trumpet sounded again. We heard the swish of underbrush, tangled by a pair of feet. One man. Perhaps he was lost, perhaps in danger. Achilles took a step towards the sound, as if in answer the trumpet came again. Then a voice bawled up the mountain,
"Prince Achilles!"
We froze.
"Achilles, I'm here for Prince Achilles!"
Birds burst from the trees, fleeing the clamour.
"From your father," I whispered.
Only a royal herald would have known where to call for us. Achilles nodded, but seemed strangely reluctant to answer. I imagined how hard his pulse would be beating. He had been prepared to kill a moment ago.
"We are here,"
I shouted into the cupped palms of my hand. The noise stopped for a moment.
"Where?"
"Can you follow my voice?" He could, though poorly. It was some time before he stepped forward into the clearing. His face was scratched, and he had sweated through his palace tunic. He knelt with ill grace, resentfully. Achilles had lowered the knife, though I saw how tightly he still held it.
"Yes,"
his voice was cool.
"Your father summons you. There is urgent business at home."
I felt myself go still as Achilles had been a moment before. If I stayed still enough, perhaps we would not have to go.
"What sort of business?" Achilles asked.
The man had recovered himself somewhat. He remembered he was speaking to a prince.
"My lord, your pardon. I do not know all of it. Messengers came to Peleus from Mycenae with news. Your father plans to speak tonight to the people, and wishes you to be there. I have horses for you below."
There was a moment of silence. Almost, I thought Achilles would decline, but at last he said,
"Patroclus and I will need to pack our things."
On the way back to the cave in Chiron, Achilles and I speculated about the news. Mycenae was far to our south, and its king was Agamemnon, who liked to call himself a lord of men. He was said to have the greatest army of all our kingdoms.
"Whatever it is, we'll only be gone for a night or two,"
Achilles told me. I nodded, grateful to hear him say it. Just a few days. Chiron was waiting for us.
"I heard the shouts,"
the centaur said. Achilles and I, knowing him well, recognized the disapproval in his voice. He did not like the peace of his mountain disturbed.
"My father has summoned me home," Achilles said. "Just for tonight. I expect I will be back soon."
"I see,"
Chiron said. He seemed larger than usual, standing there, hooves dull against the bright grass, his chestnut-colored flanks lit by the sun. I wondered if he would be lonely without us. I had never seen him with another centaur. We asked him about them once, and his face had gone stiff.
"Barbarians," he'd said.
We gathered our things. I had almost nothing to bring with me, some tunics, a flute. Achilles had only a few possessions more, his clothes and some spearheads he had made, and the statue I had carved for him. We placed them in leather bags and went to say our farewells to Chiron. Achilles, always bolder, embraced the centaur, his arms encircling the place where the horse flank gave way to flesh. The messenger, waiting behind me, shifted.
"Achilles," Chiron said, "do you remember when I asked you what you would do when men wanted you to fight?"
"Yes," said Achilles.
"You should consider your answer," Chiron said.
A chill went through me, but I did not have time to think on it. Chiron was turning to me.
"Patroclus," he said, "a summons."
I walked forward, and he placed his hand, large and warm as the sun, on my head. I breathed in the scent that was his alone, horse and sweat and herbs and forest. His voice was quiet.
"You do not give things up so easily now as you once did," he said.
I did not know what to say to this, so I said, "Thank you." A trace of smile.
"Be well."
Then his hand was gone, leaving my head chilled in its absence.
"We will be back soon," Achilles said again.
Chiron's eyes were dark in the slanting afternoon light.
I will look for you, he said.
We shouldered our bags and left the cave's clearing. The sun was already past the meridian, and the messenger was impatient. We moved quickly down the hill and climbed on the horses that waited for us. The saddle felt strange after so many years on foot, and the horses unnerved me. I half expected them to speak, but of course they could not. I twisted in my seat to look back at Pelion. I hoped that I might be able to see the Rose Quartz Cave, or maybe Chiron himself. But we were too far. I turned to face the road and allowed myself to be led to Thyre. Chapter 11. The last bit of sun was flaring on the western horizon as we passed the boundary stone that marked the palace grounds. We heard the cry go up from the guards and an answering trumpet. We crested the hill, and the palace lay before us. Behind it brooded the sea. And there, on the house's threshold, sudden as lightning strike, stood Thetis. Her hair shone black against the white marble of the palace. Her dress was dark, the color of an uneasy ocean, bruising purples mixed with churning grays. Somewhere beside her, there were guards, and Peleus too, but I did not look at them. I saw only her, and the curved knife's blade of her jaw.
Your mother, I whispered to Achilles.
I could have sworn her eyes flashed over me as if she had heard. I swallowed and forced myself onward. She will not hurt me. Chiron has said she will not. It was strange to see her among mortals. She made all of them, guards and Peleus alike, look bleached and wan, though it was her skin that was pale as bone. She stood well away from them, spearing the sky with her unnatural height. The guards lowered their eyes in fear and deference. Achilles swung down from his horse, and I followed. Thetis drew him into an embrace, and I saw the guards shifting their feet. They were wondering what her skin felt like. They were glad they did not know.
Son of my womb, flesh of my flesh, Achilles, she said.
The words were not spoken loudly, but they carried through the courtyard.
Be welcome home.
Thank you, mother, Achilles said.
He understood that she was claiming him. We all did. It was proper for a son to greet his father first. Mothers came second, if at all. But she was a goddess. Peleus's mouth had tightened, but he said nothing. When she released him, he went to his father.
Be welcome, son, Peleus said.
His voice sounded weak after his goddess wife's, and he looked older than he had been. 3 years we had been away.
And be welcome also, Patroclus.
Everyone turned to me, and I managed a bow. I was aware of Thetis's gaze, raking over me. It left my skin stinging, as if I had gone from the briar patch to the ocean. I was glad when Achilles spoke.
What is the news, father?
Peleus eyed the guards. Speculation and rumor must be racing down every corridor.
I have not announced it, and I do not mean to until everyone is gathered. We were waiting on you. Come, and let us begin.
We followed him into the palace. I wanted to speak to Achilles, but did not dare to. Thetis walked right behind us. Servants skittered from her, huffing in surprise. The goddess. Her feet made no sound as they moved over the stone floors. The great dining hall was crammed full of tables and benches. Servants hurried by with platters of food or lugged mixing bowls brimming with wine. At the front of the room was a dais raised. This is where Peleus would sit, beside his son and wife. Three places. My cheeks went red. What had I expected? Even amidst the noise of the preparations, Achilles' voice seemed loud.
Father, I do not see a place for Patroclus.
My blush went even deeper.
Achilles,
I began in a whisper. It does not matter, I wanted to say. I will sit with the men, it is all right. But he ignored me.
Patroclus is my sworn companion. His place is beside me,
Thetis's eyes flickered. I could feel the heat in them. I saw the refusal on her lips.
Very well, Peleus said.
He gestured to a servant, and a place was added for me, thankfully at the opposite side of the table from Thetis. Making myself as small as I could, I followed Achilles to our seats. She'll hate me now, I said.
She already hates you, he answered, with a flash of smile.
This did not reassure me. Why has she come? I whispered. Only something truly important would have drawn her here from her caves in the sea. Her loathing for me was nothing to what I saw on her face when she looked at Peleus. He shook his head.
I do not know. It is strange. I have not seen them together since I was a boy.
I remembered Chiron's parting words to Achilles. You should consider your answer. Chiron thinks the news will be war. Achilles frowned.
But there is always war in Mycenae. I do not see why we should have been called.
Peleus sat, and a herald blew three short blasts upon his trumpet, the signal for the meal to begin. Normally, it took several minutes for the men to gather, dawdling on the practice fields, drawing out the last bit of whatever they were doing. But this time, they came like a flood after the breaking of the winter's ice. Quickly, the room was swollen with them, jostling for seats and gossiping. I heard the edge in their voices, a rising excitement. No one bothered to snap at a servant or kick aside a begging dog. There was nothing on their minds but the man from Mycenae and the news he had brought. Thetis was seated also. There was no plate for her, no knife. The gods lived on ambrosia and nectar, on the savor of our burnt offerings, and the wine we poured over their altars. Strangely, she was not so visible here, so blazing as she had been outside. The bulky, ordinary furniture seemed to diminish her somehow. Peleus stood. The room quieted, out to the farthest benches. He lifted his cup.
I have received word from Mycenae, from the sons of Atreus, Agamemnon, and Menelaus.
The final stirrings and murmurs ceased utterly. Even the servants stopped. I did not breathe. Beneath the table, Achilles pressed his leg to mine.
There has been a crime.
He paused again, as if he were weighing what he would say.
The wife of Menelaus, Queen Helen, has been abducted from the palace in Sparta.
Helen? The hushed whisper of men to their neighbors. Since her marriage, the tales of her beauty had grown still greater. Menelaus had built around her palace walls thick with double-layered rock. He had trained his soldiers for a decade to defend it. But, for all his care, she had been stolen. Who had done it?
Menelaus welcomed an embassy sent from King Priam of Troy. At his head was Priam's son, the Prince Paris, and it is he who is responsible. He stole the queen of Sparta from her bedchamber while the king slept.
A rumble of outrage. Only an Easterner would so dishonor the kindness of his host. Everyone knew how they dripped with perfume, were corrupt from soft living. A real hero would have taken her outright with the strength of his sword.
Agamemnon and Mycenae appeal to the men of Hellas to sail to the kingdom of Priam for her rescue. Troy is rich and will be easily taken, they say. All who fight will come home wealthy and renowned.
This was well worded. Wealth and reputation were the things our people had always killed for.
They have asked me to send a delegation of men from Thyre, and I have agreed.
He waited for the murmuring to settle before adding,
though I will not take any man who does not wish to go, and I will not lead the army myself.
Who will lead it? Someone shouted.
That is not yet determined, Peleus said.
but I saw his eyes flicker to his son. No, I thought. My hand tightened on the edge of the chair. Not yet. Across from me, Thetis's face was cool and still, her eyes distant. She knew this was coming, I realized. She wants him to go. Chiron and the Rose Cave seemed impossibly far away, a childish idol. I understood, suddenly, the weight of Chiron's words. War was what the world would say Achilles was born for, that his hands and swift feet were fashioned for this alone. The cracking of Troy's mighty walls. They would throw him among thousands of Trojan spears and watch with triumph as he stained his fair hands red. Peleus gestured to Phoenix, his oldest friend, at one of the first tables.
Lord Phoenix will note the names of all who wish to fight.
There was a movement at the benches as men started to rise, but Peleus held up his hand.
There is more.
He lifted a piece of linen, dark with dense markings.
Before Helen's betrothal to King Menelaus, she had many suitors. It seems these suitors swore an oath to protect her, whosoever might win her hand. Agamemnon and Menelaus now charge these men to fulfill their oath and bring her back to her rightful husband.
He handed the linen sheet to the herald. I stared. An oath. In my mind, the sudden image of a brazier and the spill of blood from a white goat, a rich hall filled with towering men. The herald lifted the list. The runes seemed to tilt, and my eyes would not focus. He began to read. Antenor. Eurypylus. Machaon. I recognized many of the names, we all did. They were the heroes and kings of our time. But they were more to me than that. I had seen them, in a stone chamber, heavy with fire smoke. Agamemnon. A memory of a thick black beard, a brooding man with narrowed, watchful eyes. Odysseus, the scar that wrapped his calf, pink as gums. Ajax, twice as large as any man in the room, with his huge shield behind him. Philoctetes, the bowman. Menoitiades. The herald paused a moment, and I heard the murmur, "Who?" My father had not distinguished himself in the years since my exile. His fame had diminished, his name was forgotten, and those who did know him had never heard of a son. I sat frozen, afraid to move lest I give myself away. I am bound to this war. The herald cleared his throat. Idomeneus. Diomedes. Is that you? You were there. Achilles had turned back to face me. His voice was low, barely audible, but still I feared that someone might hear it. I nodded. My throat was too dry for words. I had thought only of Achilles' danger, of how I would try to keep him here, if I could. I had not even considered myself.
Listen, it is not your name any more. Say nothing. We will think what to do. We will ask Chiron.
Achilles never spoke like that, each word cutting off the next in haste. His urgency brought me back to myself a little, and I took heart from his eyes on mine. I nodded again. The names kept coming, and memories came with them. Three women on a dais, and one of them Helen. A pile of treasure, and my father's frown. The stone beneath my knees. I had thought I dreamt it. I had not. When the herald had finished, Peleus dismissed the men. They stood as one, benches scraping, eager to get to Phoenix to enlist. Peleus turned to us.
Come. I would speak further with you both.
I looked to Thetis to see if she would come too, but she was gone. We sat by Peleus's fireside. He had offered us wine, barely watered. Achilles refused it. I took a cup, but did not drink. The king was in his old chair, the one closest to the fire, with its cushions and high back. His eyes rested on Achilles.
I have called you home with the thought that you might wish to lead this army.
It was spoken. The fire popped. Its wood was green. Achilles met his father's gaze.
I have not finished yet with Chiron.
You have stayed on Pelion longer than I did, than any hero before.
That does not mean I must run to help the sons of Atreus every time they lose their wives.
I thought Peleus might smile at that, but he did not.
I do not doubt that Menelaus rages at the loss of his wife, but the messenger came from Agamemnon. He has watched Troy grow rich and ripe for years, and now thinks to pluck her. The taking of Troy is a feat worthy of our greatest heroes. There may be much honor to be won from sailing with him.
Achilles' mouth tightened.
There will be other wars.
Peleus did not nod exactly, but I saw him register the truth of it.
What of Patroclus, then? He is called to serve.
He is no longer the son of Menoetius. He is not bound by the oath.
Pious Peleus raised an eyebrow.
There is some shuffling there.
I do not think so.
Achilles lifted his chin.
The oath was undone when his father disowned him.
I do not wish to go, I said softly. Peleus regarded us both for a moment. Then he said,
Such a thing is not for me to decide. I will leave it to you.
I felt the tension slide from me a little. He would not expose me.
Achilles, men are coming here to speak with you. Kings sent by Agamemnon.
Outside the window, I heard the ocean's steady whisper against the sand. I could smell the salt.
They will ask me to fight,
Achilles said. It was not a question.
They will.
You wish me to give them audience?
I do.
There was quiet again. Then Achilles said,
I will not dishonor them, or you. I will hear their reasons, but I say to you that I do not think they will convince me.
I saw that Peleus was surprised a little by his son's certainty, but not displeased.
That is also not for me to decide, he said mildly.
The fire popped again, spitting out its sap. Achilles knelt, and Peleus placed one hand on his head. I was used to seeing Chiron do this, and Peleus's hand looked withered by comparison, threaded with trembling veins. It was hard to remember sometimes that he had been a warrior, that he had walked with gods. Achilles' room was as we had left it, except for the cot, which had been removed in our absence. I was glad. It was an easy excuse, in case anyone asked why we shared a bed. We reached for each other, and I thought of how many nights I had lain awake in this room, loving him in silence. Later, Achilles pressed close for a final, drowsy whisper.
If you have to go, you know I will go with you.
We slept. Chapter 12. I woke to the red of my eyelids straining out the sun. I was cold, my right shoulder exposed to the breezes of the window, the one that faced the sea. The space beside me on the bed was empty, but the pillow still held the shape of him, and the sheets smelled of us both. I had spent so many mornings alone in this room, as he visited his mother. I did not think it was strange to find him gone. My eyes closed, and I sank again into the trailing thoughts of dreams. Time passed, and the sun came hot over the windowsill. The birds were up, and the servants, and even the men. I heard their voices from the beach and the practice hall, the rattle and bang of chores. I sat up. His sandals were overturned beside the bed, forgotten. It was not unusual. He went barefoot most places. He had gone to breakfast, I guessed. He was letting me sleep. Half of me wanted to stay in the room until his return, but that was cowardice. I had a right to a place by his side now, and I would not let the eyes of the servants drive me away. I pulled on my tunic and left to find him. He was not in the great hall, busy with servants removing the same platters and bowls there had always been. He was not in Peleus's council chamber, hung with purple tapestry and the weapons of former Thian kings. And he was not in the room where we used to play the lyre. The trunk that had once kept our instruments sat forlorn in the room's center. He was not outside either, in the trees he and I had climbed, or by the sea, on the jutting rocks where he waited for his mother, nor on the practice field where men sweated through drills, clacking their wooden swords. I do not need to say that my panic swelled, that it became a live thing, slippery and deaf to reason. My steps grew hurried. The kitchen, the basement, the storerooms with their amphorae of oil and wine. And still I did not find him. It was midday when I sought out Peleus's room. It was a sign of the size of my unease that I went at all. I had never spoken to the old man alone before. The guards outside stopped me when I tried to enter. The king was at rest, they said. He was alone and would see no one. "But is Achilles," I gulped, trying not to make a spectacle of myself, to feed the curiosity I saw in their eyes. "Is the prince with him?"
"He is alone," one of them repeated.
I went to Phoenix next, the old counselor who had looked after Achilles when he was a boy. I was almost choking with fear as I walked to his stateroom, a modest square chamber at the palace's heart. He had clay tablets in front of him, and on them the men's marks from the night before, angular and crisscrossing, pledging their arms to the war against Troy. "The Prince Achilles," I said. I spoke haltingly, my voice thick with panic. "I cannot find him." He looked up with some surprise. He had not heard me come in the room. His hearing was poor, and his eyes, when they met mine, were rheumy and opaque with cataract.
"Peleus did not tell you, then?"
His voice was soft. "No." My tongue was like a stone in my mouth, so big I could barely speak around it.
"I'm sorry," he said kindly. "His mother has him. She took him last night as he was sleeping. They are gone. No one knows where."
Later, I would see the red marks where my nails had dug through my palms. No one knows where. To Olympus, perhaps, where I could never follow. To Africa or India, to some village where I would not think to look. Phoenix's gentle hands guided me back to my room. My mind twisted desperately from thought to thought. I would return to Chiron and seek counsel. I would walk the countryside, calling his name. She must have drugged him or tricked him. He would not have gone willingly. As I huddled in our empty room, I imagined it, the goddess leaning over us, cold and white beside the warmth of our sleeping bodies. Her fingernails prick into his skin as she lifts him. Her neck is silvery in the window's moonlight. His body lolls on her shoulder, sleeping or spelled. She carries him from me, as a soldier might carry a corpse. She is strong. It takes only one of her hands to keep him from falling. I did not wonder why she had taken him. I knew. She had wanted to separate us, the first chance she had, as soon as we were out of the mountains. I was angry at how foolish we had been. Of course she would do this. Why had I thought we would be safe? That Chiron's protection would extend here, where it never had before. She would take him to the caves of the sea and teach him contempt for mortals. She would feed him with the food of the gods and burn his human blood from his veins. She would shape him into a figure meant to be painted on vases, to be sung of in songs, to fight against Troy. I imagined him in black armor, a dark helmet that left him nothing but eyes, bronze greaves that covered his feet. He stands with a spear in each hand and does not know me. Time folded in on itself, closed over me, buried me. Outside my window, the moon moved through her shapes and came up full again. I slept little and ate less. Grief pinned me to the bed like an anchor. It was only my pricking memory of Chiron that finally drove me forth. "You do not give up so easily as you once did." I went to Peleus. I knelt before him on a wool rug, woven bright with purple. He started to speak, but I was too quick for him. One of my hands went to clasp his knees. The other reached upwards to seize his chin with my hand. The pose of supplication. It was a gesture I had seen many times, but had never made myself. I was under his protection now. He was bound to treat me fairly, by the law of the gods. "Tell me where he is," I said. He did not move. I could hear the muffled batter of his heart against his chest. I had not realized how intimate supplication was, how closely we would be pressed. His ribs were sharp beneath my cheek. The skin of his legs was soft and thin with age.
"I do not know," he said,
and the words echoed down the chamber, stirring the guards. I felt their eyes on my back. Supplicants were rare in Thyre. Peleus was too good a king for such desperate measures. I pulled at his chin, tugging his face to mine. He did not resist. "I do not believe you," I said. A moment passed.
"Leave us," he said.
The words were for the guards. They shuffled their feet, but obeyed. We were alone. He leaned forward, down to my ear. He whispered,
"Skyros."
A place, an island. Achilles. When I stood, my knees ached, as if I had been kneeling a long time. Perhaps I had. I do not know how many moments passed between us in that long hall of Thyan kings. Our eyes were level now, but he would not meet my gaze. He had answered me because he was a pious man, because I had asked him as a supplicant, because the gods demanded it. You would not have otherwise. There was a dullness in the air between us, and something heavy, like anger. "I will need money," I told him. I do not know where these words came from. I had never spoken so before, to anyone, but I had nothing left to lose.
"Speak to Phoenix. He will give it to you."
I nodded my head, barely. I should have done much more. I should have knelt again and thanked him, rubbed my forehead on his expensive rug. I didn't. Peleus moved to stare out the open window. The sea was hidden by the house's curve, but we could both hear it, the distant hiss of waves against sand.
"You may go," he told me.
He meant it to be cold, I think, and dismissive, a displeased king to his subject. But all I heard was his weariness. I nodded once more and left. The gold that Phoenix gave me would have carried me to Skyros and back twice over. The ship's captain stared when I handed it to him. I saw his eyes flicking over it, weighing its worth, counting what it could buy him. "You will take me?" My eagerness displeased him. He did not like to see desperation in those who sought passage. Haste and a free hand spoke of hidden crimes. But the gold was too much for him to object. He made a noise, grudging of acceptance, and sent me to my berth. I had never been at sea before, and was surprised at how slow it was. The boat was a big-bellied trader, making its lazy rounds of the islands, sharing the fleece, oil, and carved furniture of the mainland with the more isolated kingdoms. Every night, we put in at a different port to refill our water pots and unload our stores. During the days I stood at the ship's prow, watching the waves fall away from our black-tarred hull, waiting for the sight of land. At another time, I would have been enchanted with it all. The names of the ship's parts, halyard, mast, stern, the color of the water, the scrubbed clean smell of the winds. But I barely noticed these things. I thought only of the small island flung out somewhere in front of me, and the fair-haired boy I hoped I would find there. The bay of Skyros was so small that I did not see it until we had swung around the rocky island's southern rim and were almost upon it. Our ship narrowly squeezed between its extending arms, and the sailors leaned over the sides to watch the rocks slide by, holding their breath. Once we were inside, the water was utterly calm, and the men had to row us the rest of the way. The confines were difficult to maneuver. I did not envy the captain's voyage out.
"We are here,"
he told me sullenly. I was already walking for the gangway. The cliff face rose sharply in front of me. There was a path of steps carved into the rock, coiling up to the palace, and I took them. At their top were scrubby trees and goats, and the palace, modest and dull, made half from stone and half from wood. If it had not been the only building in sight, I might not have known it for the king's home. I went to the door and entered. The hall was narrow and dim, the air dingy with the smell of old dinners. At the far end, two thrones sat empty. A few guards idled at tables, dicing. They looked up.
"Well?"
one asked me.
"I am here to see King Lycomedes," I said.
I lifted my chin so they would know I was a man of some importance. I had worn the finest tunic I could find, one of Achilles.
"I'll go,"
another one said to his fellows. He dropped his dice with a clatter and slumped out of the hall. Peleus would never have allowed such disaffection. He kept his men well and expected much from them in return. Everything about the room seemed threadbare and grey. The man reappeared.
"Come,"
he said. I followed him, and my heart picked up. I had thought long about what I would say. I was ready.
"In here."
He gestured to an open door, then turned to go back to his dice. I stepped through the doorway. Inside, seated before the wispy remains of a fire, sat a young woman.
"I am the Princess Deidamia," she announced.
Her voice was bright and almost childishly loud, startling after the dullness of the hall. She had a tipped-up nose and a sharp face, like a fox. She was pretty, and she knew it. I summoned my manners and bowed.
"I am a stranger, come for a kindness from your father." "Why not a kindness from me?"
she smiled, tilting her head. She was surprisingly small. I guessed she would barely be up to my chest if she stood.
"My father is old and ill. You may address your petition to me, and I will answer it."
She affected a regal pose, carefully positioned so the window lit her from behind.
"I am looking for my friend."
"Oh?" Her eyebrow lifted.
"And who is your friend?"
"A young man," I said carefully.
"I see. We do have some of those here."
Her tone was playful, full of itself. Her dark hair fell down her back in thick curls. She tossed her head a little, making it swing, and smiled at me again.
"Perhaps you'd like to start with telling me your name."
"Chironides," I said, "son of Chiron." She wrinkled her nose at the name's strangeness.
"Chironides. And?"
"I am seeking a friend of mine, who would have arrived here perhaps a month ago. He is from Thyre." Something flashed in her eyes, or maybe I imagined it did.
"And why do you seek him?"
she asked. I thought that her tone was not so light as it had been. "I have a message for him." I wished very much that I had been led to the old and ill king rather than her. Her face was like quicksilver, always racing to something new. She unsettled me.
"A message."
She smiled coyly, tapped her chin with a painted fingertip.
"A message for a friend. And why should I tell you if I know this young man or not?"
"Because you are a powerful princess, and I am your humble suitor." I knelt. This pleased her.
"Well, perhaps I do know such a man, and perhaps I do not. I will have to think on it. You will stay for dinner and await my decision. If you are lucky, I may even dance for you with my women."
She cocked her head suddenly.
"You have heard of Deidamia's women?"
"I am sorry to say that I have not." She made a move of displeasure.
"All the kings send their daughters here for fostering. Everyone knows that but you."
I bowed my head sorrowfully. "I have spent my time in the mountains and have not seen much of the world." She frowned a little, then flicked her hand at the door.
"Till dinner, Chironides? I spent the afternoon in the dusty courtyard grounds. The palace sat on the island's highest point, held up against the blue of the sky, and the view was pretty, despite the shabbiness. As I sat, I tried to remember all that I had heard of Lycomedes. He was known to be kind enough, but a weak king of limited resources. Euboea to the west and Ionia to the east had long eyed his lands. Soon enough one of them would bring war, despite the inhospitable shoreline. If they heard a woman ruled here, it would be all the sooner. When the sun had set, I returned to the hall. Torches had been lit, but they only seemed to increase the gloom. Deidamia, a gold circlet gleaming in her hair, led an old man into the room. He was hunched over, and so draped with furs that I could not tell where his body began. She settled him on a throne and gestured grandly to a servant. I stood back, among the guards and a few other men whose function was not immediately apparent. Counselors, cousins, they had the same worn appearance as everything else in the room. Only Deidamia seemed to escape it, with her blooming cheeks and glossy hair. A servant motioned to the cracked benches and tables, and I sat. The king and the princess did not join us. They remained on their thrones at the hall's other end. Food arrived, hearty enough, but my eyes kept returning to the front of the room. I could not tell if I should make myself known. Had she forgotten me? But then she stood and turned her face towards our tables. "Stranger from Pelion," she called, "you will never again be able to say that you have not heard of Deidamia's women." Another gesture with a braceleted hand. A group of women entered, perhaps two dozen, speaking softly to each other, their hair covered and bound back in cloth. They stood in the empty central area that I saw now as a dancing circle. A few men took out flutes and drums, one a lyre. Deidamia did not seem to expect a response from me, or even to care if I had heard. She stepped down from the throne's dais and went to the women, claiming one of the taller ones as a partner. The music began. The steps were intricate, and the girls moved through them featly. In spite of myself, I was impressed. Their dresses swirled, and jewelry swung around their wrists and ankles as they spun. They tossed their heads as they whirled, like high-spirited horses. Deidamia was the most beautiful, of course. With her golden crown and unbound hair, she drew the eye, flashing her wrists prettily in the air. Her face was flushed with pleasure, and as I watched her, I saw her brightness grow brighter still. She was beaming at her partner, almost flirting. Now she would duck her eyes at the woman, now step close as if to tease with her touch. Curious, I craned my head to see the woman she danced with, but the crowd of white dresses obscured her. The music trilled to an end, and the dancers finished. Deidamia led them forward in a line to receive our praise. Her partner stood beside her, head bowed. She curtsied with the rest and looked up. I made some sort of sound, the breath jumping in my throat. It was quiet, but it was enough. The girl's eyes flickered to me. Several things happened at once then. Achilles, for it was Achilles, dropped Deidamia's hand and flung himself joyously at me, knocking me backwards with the force of his embrace. Deidamia screamed, "Pyrrha!" and burst into tears. Lycomedes, who was not so far sunk into dotage as his daughter had led me to believe, stood.
"Pyrrha? What is the meaning of this?"
I barely heard. Achilles and I clutched each other, almost incoherent with relief.
"My mother," he whispered. "My mother, she..." "Pyrrha!"
Lycomedes' voice carried the length of the hall, rising over his daughter's noisy sobs. He was talking to Achilles, I realized. Pyrrha, fire hair. Achilles ignored him. Deidamia wailed louder. The king, showing a judiciousness that surprised me, threw his eye upon the rest of his court, women and men both.
"Out!" he ordered.
They obeyed reluctantly, trailing their glances behind them.
"Now!"
Lycomedes came forward, and I saw his face for the first time.
His skin was yellowed, and his graying beard looked like dirty fleece. Yet his eyes were sharp enough.
"Who is this man, Pyrrha?"
"No one."
Deidamia had seized Achilles' arm, was tugging at it. At the same time, Achilles answered coolly,
"My husband."
I closed my mouth quickly so I did not gape like a fish.
"He is not! That's not true!"
Deidamia's voice rose high, startling the birds roosting in the rafters. A few feathers wafted down to the floor. She might have said more, but she was crying too hard to speak clearly. Lycomedes turned to me, as if for refuge, man to man.
"Sir, is this true?"
Achilles was squeezing my fingers. "Yes," I said.
"No!"
the princess shrieked. Achilles ignored her pulling at him, and gracefully inclined his head at Lycomedes.
"My husband has come for me, and now I may leave your court. Thank you for your hospitality."
Achilles curtsied. I noted with an idle, dazed part of my mind that he did it remarkably well. Lycomedes held up a hand to prevent us.
"We should consult your mother first. It was she who gave you to me to foster. Does she know of this husband?"
"No!"
Deidamia said again.
"Daughter!"
This was Lycomedes, frowning in a way that was not unlike his daughter's habit.
"Stop this scene. Release Pyrrha."
Her face was blotchy and swollen with tears, her chest heaving.
"No!"
She turned to Achilles.
"You are lying! You have betrayed me! Monster! Apathes!"
"Heartless." Lycomedes froze, Achilles' fingers tightened on mine. In our language, words come in different genders. She had used the masculine form.
"What was that?"
said Lycomedes slowly. Deidamia's face had gone pale, but she lifted her chin in defiance, and her voice did not waver.
"He is a man,"
she said, and then,
"we are married."
"What?"
Lycomedes clutched his throat. I could not speak. Achilles' hand was the only thing that kept me to earth.
"Do not do this," Achilles said to her. "Please."
It seemed to enrage her.
"I will do it."
She turned to her father.
"You are a fool. I am the only one who knew. I knew."
She struck her chest in emphasis.
"And now I'll tell everyone. Achilles!"
She screamed as if she would force his name through the stout stone walls, up to the gods themselves.
"Achilles! Achilles! I'll tell everyone!"
"You will not!"
The words were cold and knife-sharp. They parted the princess's shouts easily. I know that voice. I turned. Thetis stood in the doorway. Her face glowed, the white-blue of the flame's center. Her eyes were black, gashed into her skin. And she stood taller than I had ever seen her. Her hair was as sleek as it always was, and her dress as beautiful, but there was something about her that seemed wild, as if an invisible wind whipped around her. She looked like a fury, the demons that come for men's blood. I felt my scalp trying to climb off my head. Even Deidamia dropped into silence. We stood there a moment, facing her. Then Achilles reached up and tore the veil from his hair. He seized the neckline of his dress and ripped it down the front, exposing his chest beneath. The firelight played over his skin, warming it to gold.
"No more, mother,"
he said. Something rippled beneath her features, a spasm of sorts. I was half afraid she would strike him down, but she only watched him with those restless, black eyes. Achilles turned then, to Lycomedes.
"My mother and I have deceived you, for which I offer my apologies. I am the Prince Achilles, son of Peleus. She did not wish me to go to war, and hid me here as one of your foster daughters."
Lycomedes swallowed and did not speak.
"We will leave now,"
Achilles said gently. The words shook Deidamia from her trance.
"No!"
she said, voice rising again.
"You cannot! Your mother said the words over us, and we are married. You are my husband."
Lycomedes' breath rasped loudly in the chamber. His eyes were for Thetis alone.
Is this true?